So thanks for coming. Okay, so this work, L'Aquila, not so difficult, close to Rome actually, 60 miles from Rome. So this work is done in collaboration with Kunihiko Yamauchi, who's a postdoc of mine in L'Aquila, Biplab Sanyal in Uppsala, and Ivan Sergienko and Dagotto at Oak Ridge. So I will show you once more this slide that you've probably seen several times during this day to show what a multiferroic is. So basically, in a multiferroic, you have a spontaneous long-range order, long-range both dipolar and magnetic, can be ferroelectric, ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic. The bad news, which was pointed out a long time ago by Nicholas Paulding, Comsky, is that generally in standard ferroelectric, you need an empty D shell, such as titanium 4 plus in barium titanate or niobium 4 plus in potassium niobate. Whereas, of course, to achieve some magnetism, you require to have some partially filled D shell. So one needs to look for some new mechanism. So what we actually wanted to look at is how to achieve ferroelectricity in magnets. So we call this improper ferroelectricity. This means that you have ferroelectricity, the ferroelectric order, which arises as a consequence or at the same time with some other kind of ordering. So by this, but some other kind of ordering, I mean the following. So the basic idea, of course, for ferroelectricity is that you need to break inversion symmetry. And this in magnet can be done via all the electronic degrees of freedom. So one can play a little bit with the electronic degrees of freedom. So of course, you can play with spin. And so you can break inversion symmetry via spin degree of freedom, such as in spiral, as we have learned from Maxim Mostovoy last week. Or you can break the symmetry in some, if you have some kind of antiferromagnetism. And this here shows this AFME kind of antiferromagnetism, which I will discuss in closer detail later. You can also, of course, play with the charge degree of freedom. And this is what was shown in lutetium ferrite, where you have charge ordering iron 2 plus and iron 3 plus, which break inversion symmetry, and therefore charge ordering couples to ferroelectricity, and you have a ferroelectric polarization. Similar mechanism, or at least a mechanism in which you require charge ordering, it was pointed out by Van der Brink and Comsky in this PCMO, in which you can have a polarization if you have a sort of intermediate ordering between bond center and side center. You can also, of course, use the orbital degree of freedom and couple the orbital ordering to ferroelectricity. And this was done, for example, in this paper by Tokura. So you have a double layer manganite, and you get, by lowering the temperature, a transition to an orbitally ordered state in which you have a ferroelectric order. So first, we had a look at the spin degree of freedom. And we thought to couple antiferromagnetism to ferroelectricity. But of course, the question is, how big is this coupling and how big is the resulting polarization? So we started looking at this AFME, orthorhombic holmium manganite. So what is this AFME? So if you have a very strongly distorted manganite, such as the one in which you use a rare earth on the right side of the 4F element row, you basically have a strong tilting, gadolinium iron-like tilting, and your manganese, O-manganese angle can be as low as 140 degrees. So basically, this AFME is shown as follows. So you have, this is the manganese O2 plane, and you have a ferromagnetic zigzag chain, which is antiferromagnetically coupled to the neighboring chain. And on top of this, you have your other manganese O2 plane, which is also antiferromagnetically coupled to this. So the one on top of this would be a pink zigzag, and the one on top of this would be a blue zigzag. So this, as you can see, doesn't have inversion symmetry. This AFME is indeed shown to occur and occurs on the right side, as I said, when you have a small ionic radius of the rare earth, so such as holmium, manganite, lutetium, manganite, ytterbium, manganite, and so on. And this can be shown also from first principle calculation that indeed, when you have a strong distortion, the AFME is the ground state. So, for example, in yttrium manganite, in which you force to be AFME, so yttrium manganite has a complex magnetic ordering, but if you force it in the AFME, or terbium again, if you force it in AFME, the ground state is really AFME, whereas in lanthanum manganite, which is much less distorted, the ground state is AFMA. So nothing new. This is just introduction about magnetism, but now I want to talk about the relationship between ferroelectricity and manganese and investigate whether this is really a novel multiferroic through first principle density functional.
Just on the picture of the magnetic structure, you've drawn it as collinear. Is it strictly collinear? Or
it is strictly in this holmium manganite. It is strictly collinear.
Is there
yes.
some symmetry that prevents it from being from developing a
A spiral?
No, not any non-collinear component.
What do you mean symmetry? I don't understand. So yeah, strictly
What's
collinear.
The magnetic concrete symmetry?
Ah, p
PN.
Well, this I don't know exactly. I
reflection plans or something.
I think it's one that doesn't allow
PN21. Yeah, I don't. But I can tell you, I did. I did this analysis. Okay. So basically, these are the answer I will try to. This is the question I will try to answer. So what's the mechanism that gives rise to ferroelectricity? And basically, whether it's a mechanism which arises from the displacement of atoms, or it's more like an electronic mechanism. Of course, the question is, how can one achieve a ferroelectric switching? So going from one state to the one that has an opposite polarization. And and then I will draw some conclusion in the end. So yeah, just a slide on computational details. If somebody is interested in this, I've done vast calculation with the GGA, and I've used in order to treat a little bit better the correlation, I had the Hubbard U on the manganese 3D, and I've used bariphase approach to calculate polarization and non-collinear magnetism as implemented in VASP. Spin orbit is neglected. So the basic idea where I should get polarization from is the following. So if you look at this structure, and you have your octahedra projected, and you zoom this in a bigger part here, basically you have some oxygen which are coordinated to two parallel spins. And this oxygen would like to reduce the distortion, so would like to be as close as possible to 180 degrees. So we'll tend to go like this. And similar for the other oxygen, which is also coupled to parallel spin. On the other hand, you also have some oxygen which are coupled to two anti-parallel spin. And this one would like to enhance the distortion so as to maximize T2G super exchange. So this guy would like to move like this, and also this other oxygen. So you see that if you decompose in component parallel to the AC axis, actually the vertical component cancels out and the oxygen cage moves right in this case. So this should lead to a displacement of the center of mass of the oxygen compared to the manganese. So of course the picture is not so simple. So actually when you do the optimization and you move all the atoms, also, the manganese move and the oxygen displace a little bit, not on the plane, of course. But in total, if you look now at this arrow, which point out the displacement compared to a centrosymmetric configuration, basically you see that all the vertical component cancels, so the manganese moves like this, the oxygen moves like this, and indeed you have a polarization. So this is the idea that one has in mind and wants to verify from first principle. So first thing is, I've said that there is a dependence on the manganese or manganese angle on the spin configuration of the two manganese spin. But how big is this effect? So to test this in the beginning, we compare the relaxation for the oxygen when it's bonded to all ferromagnetic spin or when it's bonded to antiferromagnetic spin. So if you do that, you can see that if it's bonded to parallel spin, it's slightly higher than in the case when it's bonded antiparallel. It seems like a small difference, just 1 degree, but actually the overall effect is not so small, and it leads to a sizable polarization, as I will show later. So now we move to this AFME, where in principle you have two different manganese or manganese angle. You can have two different long bond length and short bond length. So if you do the optimization, what you have is that your angle between two parallel spin, this one, is even higher than in the binary phase, let's say. And this one is even smaller than the AFMG binary phase. So indeed, you have a pretty large difference between the alpha parallel and alpha antiparallel. So the displacement mechanism seems active.
Just theory.
Okay. This is all DFT calculation. Just I'm comparing different spin configuration, relaxed.
Does that depend on mu?
Yeah, I will show later. Yes, it depends a little bit. Yeah, not too much, I would say. I have slide.
Less relaxation if you have a larger.
Yes, so it doesn't want to move. Which is what you expect. So now the problem is how to achieve the switching. So Sergienko and Agoto published a paper in which they actually showed that there are two kinds of domain, which they call E1 and E2, which I will show you here also, that have opposite polarization. So if you look now at E1 and E2, you see that basically this spin is the same as this one. This is rotated. This is the same. And this is rotated. So we thought that the possible switching path could be a path in which we progressively rotate this central spin. So if you progressively, by constraining the direction of the magnetic moments for this central spin, and you go from here to here, one should switch the polarization. And you see that in this intermediate state, every oxygen here sees two manganese which have the spin which are perpendicular. So in this configuration, all the oxygen are equivalent, so I don't expect any polarization for this. This should be my paraelectric state. This should be a ferroelectric state with one polarization, and this should be the other ferroelectric polarization with the other ferroelectric state with opposite polarization. So now, of course, to see if my ferroelectricity is stable, I need to check whether this is this mechanism of the oxygen becoming progressively inequivalent holds. And so, for example, I look at this 90 degree or perpendicular, as I will call you in the following. So here, when I have, this is the manganese or manganese angle. When I have 90 degrees of spin, here is the direction of the central spin, every oxygen sees the same environment. So alpha parallel and alpha antiparallel, of course, coincide. But as I progressively switch to the E, they become progressively inequivalent. So this mechanism holds.
So did you try rotating this way rather than this way? See what I mean? Maybe go back a picture.
Sure.
Back another one. So instead of taking your spin and going like this, going into the plane like this.
Well, actually, Nicola, it's spin orbit. I don't know if this answers your question, but spin orbit is not included. So I guess if I rotate like this or like this, it doesn't make sense because
sort of relative spin.
Relative makes sense, but I didn't investigate whether I can rotate this or this because it's the same in my formalism. I simply
relative to these two though. If I do this or if I do this,
you just do a global rotation around this axis.
Yeah, so you'd be rotating about the same axis as your as your antiferromagnetic vector or perpendicular to your antiferromagnetic vector?
I don't think it makes. Yeah, because I mean, the relative angle would be the same.
You just
right?
take the intermediate configuration mm-hmm. here and do a 90-degree rotation around the vertical axis in spin space, only the spin rotation. So then now it would be.
I'll think about it. I think it's different even without spin orbit coupling. Because right now your spins are like this and you're going like this, right? So this this angle is relative. Or like that.
Okay, come on, you cannot do
rotate like that to get to the other side rather than like this. Those are different, I think, even without spin orbit coupling.
I think the relative angle is the same.
Okay, I have to work on my
But a good question is, of course, whether they, I mean, I don't expect, well, it's spin orbit coupling. This I didn't investigate, but that's might be different. And of course, it makes sense to verify this.
Crystal
on his own.
But I'll think
about it in the day. Yeah, okay. Okay. So now let's go back to this ferroelectric switching. So to have a ferroelectric state, I need my total energy to be lower. So what I did is plotting the total energy along this switching path. So I start with my E structure, and then I progressively rotate this central spin. And what total energy does, it increases up to a maximum, which is my paraelectric state. And then it goes down again when I switch from E1 to E2. So this is a kind of double well, which is a signature of ferroelectricity. And from here, you can also have an estimate of how deep is this well, and how easy is, of course, in experiment to actually rotate, because at least you have to overcome this barrier. So I'm not saying that this is actually what happens in truth, that really you have this state and then you go through this state, but at least it represents an upper bound. So if you compare this quantity, 8 mEV per formula unit, with barium titanate, where you have 18, at least seems switchable. So this is not a big, it's not an extremely big number.
So where does the number come from, barium titanate? Is that a theoretical number?
It's similar, but I guess you move the oxygen, you move the titanium.
It's a theoretical number, though.
It's a theoretical number, yes. Yes, yes. okay. Yes, so before I go into the polarization, I just wanted to show that I have an insulating character all along the switching path. So you have your this is my EG band, hybridized between EG and oxygen. This is the T2G band and EG. So basically the gap is here. And I don't have a tremendously big differences if I switch the spin. Basically the electronic structure looks pretty much the same. I have some minor differences, but still, at least from the insulating character, this is kept all along the switching path.
So this is U equals 0.
This is U equals 0. Yeah, everything I will show is U equals 0, except in the last part. Okay, so now I, of course, want to look at polarization. And the first thing I do is I have my atoms relax. They are relaxing in a ferroelectric fashion, if I estimate the polarization from point charge model, so I consider oxygen minus 2, manganese 3 plus, holmium 3 plus, this is what I get, along also as a function of this switching path. So if I look at now at the numbers, they are pretty big. They are of the order of 2 micro 2 or 3 microcoulomb per centimeter square. So this is a rather big number, at least compared to other manganite, in which you have a much smaller polarization, and also where the mechanism is different because it's spin orbit driven, whereas here it's like exchange driven. So also I get this switching, so of course one should be able to tune via an electric field whether I have this kind of domains or this kind of domains. So I should be able to have an electrical control of the antiferromagnetic domains. Of course, point charge model is very crude. I have a much better way to estimate the polarization, which is through Berry phase. And if I do that, this is what I get. So from the difference here, I can imagine that my wave function, my orbital, can play a role, because I mean there is a big difference between point charge model and density and Berry phase treatment. So to clarify better this concept, what I do is the following. I take the atoms in this configuration, which is centrosymmetric. So I don't let my atoms move. And what I do is just switching the direction of the spin from here to here or from here to here. So my atoms are fixed. I'm not moving them. I'm forcing them to stay in a centrosymmetric fashion. And what I get is this pink curve, which also shows a big polarization. And this polarization, which is about 3 microcoulomb per centimeter square. So here, as I said, I'm not moving the atoms. All the polarization that I see is coming from my wave function. And I have my charge density, or charge density, which is affected by the antiferromagnetic coupling, which breaks inversion symmetry.
So centrosymmetric, you mean with respect to crystal structure? Not the magnetic structure.
Exactly. So the magnetic structure is centrosymmetric somehow here, but then as soon as I move from here to here, or from here to here, I break it. So this is what I mean by the title of my talk. So I say this is a dual nature of the ferroelectric polarization. Because basically, of course, if I relax the atom, they go from here to here. So this final and overall polarization that I get, which is about 6 microcoulomb, seems to be somehow originated both from this pinkish one, which is breaking inversion symmetry via antiferromagnetism, but also, of course, by an ionic contribution, because then, of course, the atoms want to relax and the polarization goes from here to here. And, at least personally, I would have expected that this to be very small. It's not. It's pretty big. So it's quite, it seems to be sort of additive.
So you add the two? Or?
If you?
It's pretty close.
It's pretty close. Yeah. Pretty close.
And if you will increase U, you will decrease the pink curve and also the red one.
Yes. Yes, because hopping basically it's depressed. I can show you. So of course. We were collaborating with Dagotto and Sergienko, and they did this Landau theory of phase transition for my system. So they were able to extract the polarization, which has a B component, which is zero, and there is an A component and C component. But these two, these and these, they have a relativistic origin. So they actually come from the coupling of P to the product of the A and C component of the magnetic moments. And since I'm neglecting this this coupling because I don't have any spin orbit coupling mechanism in my simulation, what I basically see is only this term, which has a cosinus dependent, which agrees, of course, with what I've shown you before. I wanted to have a feeling of why this oxygen differs so much, even if they are structurally equivalent, so their bond length to the manganese are the same, they look different because they are coupled to parallel spin or anti-parallel spin. So what we did is, this is the density of states. So here I have my EG oxygen P band, and I plotted the charge density. This is the centrosymmetric structure. So one from structure would expect this oxygen to be the same as this oxygen, as this and this. But if you look at this oxygen, which is coordinated to two anti-parallel spin, and this oxygen, which is coordinated to two anti-parallel spin, you can already see that they are inequivalent. Also here, of course, one can see the,
hybridization.
So also here, one expects this G like orbital ordering. Of course, I didn't exactly evaluate the coefficient of orbital ordering, but already from here one can see that there is a certain degree of orbital ordering.
So is the blob the magnitude of the charge density in that pink region of the density
state? This is like an isosurface. So I basically construct the charge density only from here, and then I draw a kind of isosurface for I don't remember which value, but it's an isosurface. Also, another way to quantitatively estimate how these oxygen become inequivalent is through Born effective charges. So if I move now a little bit my oxygen, what is the change in polarization that I get? So this is, of course, a tensor. But in this calculation, I only moved the oxygen along the c-axis, and I was calculating the change in polarization along the same axis. So what I expect, of course, and what I get, is that if I do it in this perpendicular structure, where all my oxygen are inequivalent, I don't have any difference between parallel and antiparallel, of course. So I get a number from the oxygen and a number from the manganese. But if I do that for the FME, where I have a sort of inequivalency, I get some differences. If you look at this number,
So locally, the manganese is in the center of symmetric coordination. If you look only at four oxygens surrounding it. But if you look at a bigger circle around, then it's not in more center symmetric. Is that the point? Because if the manganese is center symmetric, then why would the wave function change there?
But the oxygen. So yeah, okay. I think it's okay in the centrosymmetric structure. The only difference you get is because you have oxygen, which are inequivalent, right?
Okay.
But when you relax, then of course the manganese move and they are different. So you can have different bond length, manganese bond length, if they are ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic.
And you move off-center because you see the larger.
Yes. But if I look just at the centrosymmetric, all my polarization comes from the oxygen. I guess this is what you want to say. Okay, so if you look at this number, they are not so anomalous. I mean, this Z star in standard ferroelectric can be, I don't know, 5 or 7. These are not so different from their nominal valence, which is 3 and -2. So I still have a rather ionic picture here. Of course, everybody's asking, well, how about correlation? So if I include a U, of course the structure doesn't want to relax. The atoms are more, somehow the bond length and the angle are more tight. And so if you increase the U from 0 to 8, what you have is this. So this black is for ferromagnetic, this red is for antiferromagnetic. And then the green and the blue, they are for a parallel and anti-parallel manganese-manganese angle in the FME. So even if you apply a U, you still get this inequivalency between the alpha in the parallel with two parallel spin and alpha anti-parallel, alpha with the anti-parallel spin. And these two, even if you have a big U, they still differ. They differ less, by less than 1 degree, but they still differ. So if you do a polarization,
if you apply U, you still have E structure of the ground
state. Critical question. Okay.
I mean
the energetics is something I don't trust too much. So if I don't apply a U, I get a FME as ground state. But if I apply a U, I always tend to enhance the ferromagnetic coupling. I tend to depress anti-ferromagnetic exchange. So if I apply U equal 8, then what I get is a ferromagnetic ground state. I don't know whether this comes from, I don't know, some error, or some not error, but I didn't minimize the lattice parameter. So I don't know what's actually wrong, but I don't get the FME in the U. This is why I say the energetics, I don't trust so much.
It's a different symmetry that comes to ground state. So
yes.
Yes.
Yes. So, but basically what I wanted to show here is that I wanted to have a look at the effects on P. On P. And this is what I get. So even if I have a very large P, a very large U, I still get a polarization. This is just point charge model. But it goes from 2 to 0.7. It's not zero. It's not killed. So, and this I pretty much like. I mean, I expect that there still might be some difference between the parallel and anti-parallel configuration. So basically, here I'm plotting the polarization, and on the right scale, I'm plotting this difference between alpha parallel and alpha anti-parallel. So this is the intuitive argument I have. So U is the energy I need to pay to add one more electron. So if I put a U, then hopping decreases. It's more difficult for the electron to hop. So if I increase the U, hopping is less favored. And since I basically need this kind of difference, if I depress hopping, then I also depress this quantity. Therefore, polarization goes down. But not so much. I mean, it doesn't go to zero. It's not completely killed. This is what I wanted to say. Now, some bad news. So if I want to compare now experiment, that is something I have to say. So experimentally, holmium manganide would like to be, the ground state would like to be hexagonal. It's not orthorhombic. You can grow it orthorhombic if you apply high pressure synthesis, and you can get holmium manganite in the orthorhombic structure. But this is polycrystalline. And so Paul Chu and Bern Lorenz did that. They have a polycrystalline samples. And this is what they get. They see a polarization through pyroelectric current. P is much smaller than what we get. And
a lot smaller.
A lot smaller. Yeah. Way smaller. Yeah.
Three.
Two order of magnitude smaller. And this might still come from the fact that they have grains and I have a single crystal. But what we are actually, we're still thinking of is that they see an increase in the polarization below the ordering temperature of holmium 4F spins. And holmium, they order non-collinear. I don't know if it's sinusoidal. I don't remember, but it's very hard for us. The holmium, it's commensurate. In any case, I think we both have to make a better job. So experiment
macro. Also, if they have multiple anti-ferromagnetic domains in the sample, so if the L vector changes, then the polarization will go to zero.
I don't know if this big difference.
Zero if you have two anti-ferromagnetic
domains.
No, but
if you apply a field, if you apply a field, but they say they don't saturate somehow. They say something that it's not. I mean, they cannot order all the domains.
Can you get your anti-ferromagnetic
effect as a line? But wouldn't you probably you pull the electric polarization?
Oh, and that drags the anti-ferromagnetic domains along with
that.
Okay.
But still, is something that we. Makes, I mean, probably something more is needed, some further work is needed to reconcile.
So large, then you should easily be able to hold.
Yeah.
Because the electrical energy should be bigger than the isotropy energy.
Yeah. So, of course, there might be some kind of interplay between the holmium 4F spin and manganese 3D spin, and therefore on polarization. So I still think that, you know, to have the final word on this compound, one needs to do further work. So basically the summary.
It's huge, right? I mean, it's orders of magnitude off.
How do you differentiate between magnetoelectric and multiferolic effects?
In my calculation?
No, in these measurements.
Well, magnetic field zero, it's obviously multiferolic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they also see. Yes. So yeah, this is as a function
of. Might be
even if you apply a U, it goes low, but not that low. So I don't think it's a correlation. I mean. I don't know. Okay, U is not the proper way to treat correlation.
I'd say in general that DMT calculations are probably more accurate than experiments. Experiments is really hard to do.
Ferroelectrics.
Complete switching. Yeah. So the spread in. If you think about the bismuth trihydrate case, you know, the spread of the measurements was 3 to 150 micrograms per centimeter. That all the calculations got between like 85 and 95. So it's not a very hard calculation to make. It's a very hard experiment to make.
Yeah.
For new material, if I can, you would. But I mean, they are very hard experiments to do. In general, thoroelectric polarization. So they're just very different. Well, why is there this huge spread in the experimental numbers in general?
The experiments are not very difficult, but you have to, first you have to have good samples.
Okay.
And if you don't have good samples, then you get all kinds of artifacts, and that depends a bit on the computation.
So Sylvia's samples are perfect, right?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know, thin films might be easier. I don't know, or I mean, to at least avoid this polycrystalline character of the sample.
Did Paul Salvador have films of polymicronite
in there? No, I think Ramesh said that he grew some, but they didn't measure polarization.
That's a naive theorist question, which is, even if you have a polycrystalline sample, couldn't you in principle measure powder X-ray diffraction and measure directly the atomic displacements, at least the differences in distances?
This is not done.
Closely connected to what you're calculating.
Sure. I'm not aware of any. I don't think there is in the literature or something like this, but yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you can do that, though. It depends on the number of the minerals that you're introducing. If you have a very tight domain.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. Assuming the domains are reasonable size. Sure. I mean, I guess you would see that in the X-ray, though, if you see a real broad width. Has that been tried?
No, there is
the crystal structure of folding magnetite.
Let's say some ferroelectric material like this.
And I think until now,
people
thought that we wouldn't have to worry about it. And to make the distinction between a polar and a non-polar state is one of the most difficult problems in crystallography experimentally. Mm-hmm. Unless you don't have to, you impose centrosymmetric symmetry.
In 113, they expected shift going into the electric state is 1,000 of angstrom.
Here is much larger. I mean, it's much larger. I mean, I see differences of 0.01 angstrom in my bond length, even larger, 0.02. So it's of course it's not a big as in barium titanate.
Your relaxations would be far off. Suppose you are completely wrong.
Got the electronic part, which is very big. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
May I come back on the domain wall? Mm-hmm. How much do you expect the domain wall to be?
Don't make me this question, I cannot answer.
No, but this is the electromagnetic domain, so it is actually different. It's not, you know, created by, you know, one range interactions, etc.
I appreciate that, but on the other hand, I expect that it is much smaller than in the regular electromagnet. No? It's coupled to a ferromagnetic distortion.
Well, you mean it should be ferroelectric domain? Oh, but,
correct.
But those probably should have very large size because polarization is small. I don't know. No, but this, in any case, you can hold, right? So if you apply it.
Well, I was going the other way. Could you do spin wave experiments? Because your spin wave stiffness should be different for such domain walls than for non-polar domain walls.
Again, I don't know anything that it has been done on this compound so far.
And is the magnetic structure verified experimentally?
Yes, I think this was verified by a long time ago by Alonso. I mean, like in the 80s or something. But the FME is, by neutron. This is verified.
I have a question on the experiment. I would expect the magnetic field to help cold the sample. So if they go to higher magnetic field, the sample itself should become better cold.
Yeah.
So I expect to see a higher.
Well, it goes. What's the argument? Yeah, I don't know. What's the effect on this holmium for F?
Were they electrically pulling the sample at low temperature?
I think so. Yes, electrically. Yeah.
Random polarization.
They said that they didn't achieve saturation. But I mean, this is open. If you have suggestion, help me to explain, because of course this is a problem for me. I mean, I can. I mean, this effect of holmium for F for us, it's basically we cannot simulate, so we cannot really, you know, compare the effect on polarization. We expect it to be pretty small. I mean, if I look at my band structure, they simply don't have holmium for, I mean, holmium for F is just, you know, very narrow, and then the other holmium states are simply not there. They are like in the unoccupied range. And I don't expect if I switch now a non-collinear, this to change the situation. But this is, of course, my intuitive argument. I cannot prove it. Okay, summary. So basically, I see a very big effect. My polarization is pretty large, and it comes also from a displacement mechanism is large, because I still see 2 or 3 microcoulomb per centimeter squared, which is, of course, much larger than any other improper magnetic ferroelectrics studied so far. We proposed a kind of ferroelectric switching path via spin rotation. And so there is a dual nature. So this, of course, you know, when you do model Hamiltonian studies, generally one can focuses on either this electronic or magnetic contribution or from the ions. Of course, when you do a DFT calculation, you have them both. So you can, and we saw that they are both relevant. So whenever you want to evaluate actually the values of P, we think it should contain both. And we think it should be rather general. When you have an improper magnetic ferroelectric, there should always be a contribution which comes from breaking inversion symmetry via electronic mechanism plus the ions movement. A little bit on what we are just working on these days. So we wanted to have a look at these other manganites. So of course, when you move from lanthanum or praseodymium right, You see a decrease in the manganese or manganese angle, which is what we also see from first principle. And these actually affects our magnetism in general. Oh yeah, also the bond length, also you can plot and compare with experiments, but also what we were mostly looking at is the effect on the J's and the effect on the polarization. So these are really preliminary results. So what we did is plug our total energy into a simply Heisenberg model, which is, I agree, not the most accurate. So please keep this number with a reasonable critical eye. But still, if you use simply Heisenberg, what you have is an in-plane. We use an in-plane first neighbor and second neighbor J's, and two out-of-plane first neighbor and second neighbor. So you see your J1, ferromagnetic J1, progressively decreasing, and this J2 is also yes. This second neighbor, on the other hand, is pretty constant and pretty large. The out of plane is basically not so important. It's rather rather constant behavior, and J2 out of plane is basically zero. So if you now want to reconcile this number with what happens in truth and the FME stabilization or some kind of non-collinear, basically, what you have is that you have a region here in which you have a predominance of this ferromagnetic coupling in plane and antiferro out of plane. So you have your FMA, then a kind of intermediate region where you have some spiral and or in general frustration, and then you have a stabilization of the FME. So we are working actually on getting vector J. So like hopping parameters. But what I wanted to show you in the last part is this. So if I force now all the manganites to be in the FME structure, which is of course valid only here. So if you look at the experiment, only the very distorted one actually want to be in the FME. But if I force all the manganite to be in the FME, by point charge model, I basically get a constant values. But the polarization goes really high, up to 12 microcoulomb per centimeter square. Again, goes up on the wrong side because here FME is stable, here is never stable. I don't think it can be stabilized in FME structural lanthanum manganite, because also from calculation I see a huge difference between the stability of FME compared to FMA in lanthanum manganite. But still, here I see a huge effect of the electronic polarization. So the ions are pretty much constant, and they produce, let's say, a pretty similar effective field, but the electron seems to be much more polarizable, let's say, in lanthanum manganite compared to distorted one. So we are investigated whether orbital ordering and hopping term might be the reason of this big polarization. Because of course, the argument, intuitive argument, would be that if I have a very strongly distorted, like in holmium manganite, when I have a very small angle, hopping is less favorable. When I have, a lanthanum, a larger angle, then hopping is more favorable. But actually, I would then expect something like this. Whereas I see a kind of saturation. So we're, still in the process of understanding this. So, yeah, take home message is what I have repeated several times. So you have a dual nature of polarization in compounds, which comes from both displacement of atoms and electronic effects. Now I want to come back to my first question: how can we induce ferroelectricity in magnet? So I said one can look at spin degree of freedom, charge degree of freedom, orbital degree of freedom. So far we have only looked at this spin degree of freedom. But if you have some good candidate for testing the coupling of charge and orbital degree of freedom to polarization, I would be happy to discuss. Thanks for your attention.
What about the half-dome system that we kind of there, the CE?
See, but the CE, I never thought whether also there, can you, I'm not sure you can, no, your inversion
you
symbol.
Combine it, yeah, you have inversion symbol, but just combine it with iron that will leave distortion.
Yes. Okay. I also don't know about, yeah, but this is something, I mean, also wanted to test your system. I mean, your system is one candidate. Of course, I don't know how DFT is good in getting the shot. 50%.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's very close to E.
Yes. Sure.
What's a reasonable value of U? And therefore, well, what polarization do you really expect for holmium?
Yeah, okay, holmium, I mean, there are no photoemission experiments for holmium manganite. If I take lanthanum manganite, which is the closest system, I think U is 6 or 8. It's pretty large.
So
yeah. But as I said, I mean, it depends on what you're looking at. So polarization, if you say U equals 6, is about 1. What did I say?
That was
point charge model.
So
I'm doing. I don't know the Berry phase value, but I don't know. It's it would be not 6. It would be 3 or 4. It's still big. I mean, it's still big polarizing.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. In barium titanate, you get 30. Right? Still. You know, small. I mean, these are not compared. You know, the ordering temperature are 26 Kelvin. So yeah, I'm not saying that these are really, you know, functional material that one can use them, but it's, yeah, some kind of basic physics. Yeah, this we'll see.
You mentioned orbital degrees of freedom,
mm-hmm,
in these manganites.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand why the orbital ordering temperature increases from lanthanum manganites and almost diverges by the time that you arrive to holmium manganite?
By orbital or?
Well, it becomes very stable.
But orbital with us, but orbital, yeah. So I think if you look at the coefficient, I mean, we are doing that, so I cannot answer you. But the degree of orbital ordering saturates. This is right. Saturates from lanthanum to holmium to lutetium, right? If you look at some paper by Alonso. So this is why I said it's maybe related to polarization. Is maybe related to orbital ordering. Mm.
Don't know if it saturates. What I've seen is that it really goes off scale and people have not done reliable measurements because the stabilization energy becomes very large by the time that you get to in commensurate phases.
Okay.
The question was if there is any relation there.
Mm-hmm. Not that I know. No. I cannot comment.
To which extent latency relaxation is responsible actually for stabilization of this E phase, say, compared to spiral phases? Yeah?
Lattice parameter?
Yes, yeah, so lattice, spin latest relaxation usually becomes collinear. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
To which extent actually that, you know, works to stabilize this E phase?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Probably a small number because the EG.
No, simply when you have maximum possible, or so scalar product is maximal or minimal possible, yeah, then, you know, latest relaxation, you know, tries to stabilize it or effectively gives you bi-quadratic
mm-hmm.
speed.
Mm-hmm.
So and maybe that's how the base winds kind of
to decompose, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does the cerium compound also exist in the manganite here?
Cerium, I think, yes. Let's see, because we have.
Cerium.
That's why I'm asking.
I think, I don't know, actually. Also here, I mean, especially for these, the lattice parameter we were finding, so basically only two groups, I think, have worked on this very distorted manganite. One is Paul Chu, and then Goodenough is working. And then there is a long, some report, I don't know, in the 90s, and the for example, lattice parameter were pretty much different. So
serum, usually you expect the F moment to be slightly less localized, right? Mm-hmm. Less core like than for all the other.
Okay.
Ones.
Okay.
So maybe that leads to some interesting
things. Okay. Serum.
It's not difficult to experimentally do serum because in air it wants to go to 4+. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Pretty much you need to use to make it. You have to do it to make it better control than I mean, I've noticed a lot of the perovskites I've worked on, they often leave off serum. That's not because it's not makeable, but it's just because experimentally people were doing the sintering in air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, another, I don't know, conceptual question. Suppose that you're right, and say it should be a large polarization experiment, like, you know, mm-hmm. But the question is, will you be able to observe these materials, you know, things like what you observe in spiral materials, so this, I don't know, giant from the past, so polarization by itself will be large, but will it give rise to large dielectric constant? I mean, can you manipulate the same way as you manipulate the spiral? Yeah, also that will be better. Well, that's probably
Seems like maybe this is a good point to break off.